antenna system. He even went as far as bringing in his rig, which he plugged in a 100-watt rig, got me on, went on, and this was 40-meter dipole, got me on the air, and it worked perfect. When I hook up my rig, it will not work. He scratched his head and says, I really can't help you. I spent the money to repack this radio and ship it back to the manufacturer at my court because they found absolutely nothing wrong with the radio. What am I looking at before I throw this whole works out and forget about ham radio, period? What is going on? You got me, Dick.
That does sound like a fairly tough case. But there are a number of relatively simple measurements that should be made. The manufacturer tried to confirm whether or not the transmitter is working correctly, and apparently there was a non-confirm. The next test that I would have done is with some kind of directional power sensing device, like a bird watt meter. I'd really like to take the output of the transmitter through the bird watt meter into a known 50-ohm dummy load. Will it, in your shack, transmit a signal into a 50-ohm dummy load? Gotta do that. And if it doesn't, then there's a whole series of investigations that triggers you into. The next thing is that even though a antenna analyzer, impedance analyzer, was connected to his antenna, and on 40 meters it seemed to be pretty good, bear in mind now that the standing wave sensing circuitry in the transmitter, let me drop.
But he emphasized that his friend brought a rig over, was able to hook up the rig, and it worked perfect.
I agree. Another rig on his antenna worked perfectly. And the antenna analyzer at 40 meters said he's got a good antenna. But his rig connected to that antenna became unhappy. And the only thing that becomes unhappy with the rig, if it's working correctly, is that when it sees a certain amount of reverse power flowing down the transmission line toward the transmitter, when that exceeds a certain threshold, the transmitter assumes that the signal is coming from antenna reflection, standing wave ratio of the antenna, and therefore it trips out into a lower power mode or stops transmitting entirely. There is the possibility that some other local transmitter in his neighborhood, which puts signal on some other frequency down his antenna and false alarms his particular sensitive circuit in his transmitter. That's a possible guess. And you would have seen that immediately as a difference when you transmit it to a dummy load versus a non-dummy load. Now, when it comes to solving crazy problems like this, Barry has run into a few of these. Let's see what Barry's got to say. N2MB, what do you think's going on here, Barry? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Yeah, well, I found in the past when you have some kind of RF feedback, that's usually why this craziness is happening. Some radios will do it, and you put another brand next to it, you don't get the RF feedback. It should unplug the microphone, of course, and, you know, make sure that every pass that he can possibly have for RF feedback is covered. Try the rig in CW or something like that and see if he can load the antennas in. My best guess is this fellow is getting RF feedback, because I've seen it a million times like that.
But the RF feedback should be on the appropriate frequency where the antenna still presents a good load. Although, I see what you're saying now. Although the antenna presents a good load, maybe the antenna, because of it not having a proper balancing structure at the antenna, that the antenna is launching a substantial amount of RF energy down the outside of the coax, which comes back into the shack and false alarms that reverse power sensing circuitry. And along the lines of what you're saying, Barry, I would have first transmitted with a bird watt meter into a dummy load and convince yourself before that 100 watts is going forward and no power is coming back. Then the next test would be eliminate the microphone, plug in the Morse code key. Can you transmit Morse code into your antenna? And then with the microphone eliminated to eliminate what you're calling RF feedback. Let's see if you have some further questions or comments on this one, Barry. Into Moonbound, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. He should start by transmitting really low power. Try it that way. You know, a whole lot of things, anything he can to eliminate the possibility. Oh, yeah. The other thing is, how far from his rig is the antenna? Because I had a situation, I can't even operate in this car on low bands. I just can't do it because of that very problem. This car has a plastic roof, and the antenna is less than 5 feet from the radio, and it's just a hopeless case. If I put the rig in the house, I have no problem. Or, of course, if I put it into a dumbo load, I have no problem. So I'm thinking he has a similar condition. This antenna might be, you know, if you look at it, it's on his roof. It's probably like 10 feet away from his radio, things like that. And he's just running into a problem that another brand, he might not have that problem.
Yeah, Barry, you brought up another very good point. When the rig trips out because it thinks it sees reverse power that's putting the final stage in danger, that reverse power sensing circuit is looking for a finite amount of reverse power. I'm going to pick some numbers out of the air. Assume that your 100-watt transmitter can tolerate up to 10 watts coming back. And beyond 10 watts coming back, it goes into the non-transmit mode or goes into a lower power mode. It trips out, let's say. By way of sneaking up on it, in other words, set the transmitter controls in such a way you're only transmitting 1 watt, 5 watts, 10 watts, 15 watts, slowly sneak up on it, and even if the antenna is doing something really weird, and if there's RF feedback on the outside of the cable and whatever, still, there's probably some amount of power you can transmit where it doesn't trip out, and finding that threshold, and then making changes in the system, changing the length of the cable, the layout of the antenna, and so on, so that you can move in the direction of a higher amount of power output before it trips out. So there's a whole series of experiments that can be done here. I can see what happened at the factory. At the factory, they put it into a pure 50-ohm dummy load, a perfectly shielded system, and even if the reverse detecting circuitry in that rig was very sensitive, they never had the condition, therefore they never saw what he was seeing in his shack. So it looks to me like, Mel, you and I are about to assign to this writer to you a number of homework assignments of doing those experiments, dummy load if possible, sneaking up on it in power if possible, operating with a Morse code key without the microphone connected, making any changes to the antenna you can think of, changing length of cable layout, moving the rig so it's positioned a different way on the table, and then by way of him going to the lower power output mode and then not tripping out, and then he makes any changes he can think of, and
repeat it, timeout. Yeah, you know, another thing he could do, Dick, he could try, if he gets it working at all, he could try bringing it back to life using ferrite beads on the outside of the coax, on the microphone connection, on the power lead, just everywhere, you know? Sit there with a whole bunch of ferrite beads. That might get him a little higher in power before he runs into the trouble yet again, you know?
Good suggestions, Barry. As I see it now, we got to give this guy some enthusiasm. We've got to give him some encouragement here. I've seen a guy run into a persistent problem with a rig, get angry, hit it with a sledgehammer, and give up ham radio. And I know how a situation like this can become very frustrating, but there are other things to be tried that haven't been tried yet. So not enough of the experiments have been run, and so a lot of these experiments should be run as I see it, Mel. Wonder if you think you're going to be able to talk him into it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, you know what else he could try? Put a dummy load at the end of the feed line, just before the antenna. See if everything is still working. If it's still working when he does that, then the next thing he should try to do is move the antenna. I got a funny feeling it's very close to his radio.
This is JXM. Okay, Mr. JXM, go right ahead.
Yeah, I don't think... Gary over here, I just want to throw in one thing. Maybe the final is tripping out, not because of that stuff, but because the thermal is on the panel.
Yes, the way was described to us, though, Gary, it sounds like it trips out immediately. It's not a thermal overload yet. But even that, again, if he sets the rig to transmit a lower amount of power output, even if it's a thermal overload situation, it's going to take longer to happen. So there's a whole series of suggestions, and let's hope that we can decrease this guy's frustration, Mel. And it's a good set of questions. I'm glad you went through with it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Bravo, Delta with comment.
A very weak signal that said Delta with a comment. Go ahead.
Turn it to me. Did I make a mistake?
November, I suggest.
The Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Feedback now. I think that was N2 Bravo Delta or somebody with a call like that, and not making it because of all the feedback. Go ahead, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
But the crux of this thing is why his friend says that the handheld indicator says that the antenna is perfect. His friend brings the rig there, and he's got a one-to-one, and his rig works perfect. Why this particular rig don't work, this is what I can't understand. If he had said his SWR, he would tell me his SWR is 3-to-1, something like that, I would say. He says his SWR, his friend's rig shows it's a one-to-one, over.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta.
Okay, try again. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. Go ahead.
Roger, Dick. My thoughts are that perhaps the transceiver is transmitting and receiving on different frequencies. A lot of these rigs have dual VFOs. It might be in a mode where it's transmitting on one VFO and receiving on another VFO, in which case would make it kind of hard to make a contact. Over.
Yeah, you'd have to very carefully look at the instrument panel to know what frequency it's transmitting on, to make sure that you're not running into that pilot error type situation. That's a pretty good one. So, why in the world am I getting this crazy response here on my computer? So you got to make sure that it's not in a crazy mode, and that's not easy to do. The front panel should tell you. Almost always when you put a transmitter in the transmit mode, the front panel, if you know to look at it correctly, will tell you what frequency it's transmitting on. So that's another factor. And again, sneaking up on it in power by setting it to a lower power mode. But to answer Mel's question, let me drop it. The impedance analyzer is telling you what impedance exists between the center conductor and the shield of the transmission line. The impedance analyzer has no knowledge of what's going on outside the transmission line. So if the layout of the antenna, the lack of a balun at the antenna, or whatever, is giving you a substantial amount of RF energy flowing back down the outside of the coax, the impedance analyzer doesn't know that. But some rigs have enough RF pickup with RF in the shack to through the microphone cable, through the power cable, or whatever, and then the sensitive circuitry that's looking for reverse power becomes false alarmed. That's a possible guess. So, is he really on the right frequency when he's transmitting? Can he sneak up on it with lower power with the microphone disconnected? Can he operate it in the Morse code mode? Can he try, even though the antenna is made for 40 meters, what the hell, at low power output, try it on 80 meters, try it on 20 meters, try it into a dummy load, try the dummy load at the far end of the coax cable. There's a lot of other experiments to be run, and properly analyzing all of those answers are going to give you a lot more information of what's going on here. K2KEY, give him some encouragement if you possibly can, Mel.
Yes, yes.
K2RIW, go ahead, Mel.
If he sends it back to the manufacturer, I'm sure, Dick, the manufacturer knew how to check a rig out. I'm sure of it, that they thoroughly checked it. They were on frequency with it. And then why is his friend's rig working properly? And he's got a tuner even in the line. They even tried a tuner in the line. They can't make it work. I don't know the answer. I'm going to say right now that I am stumped. Maybe if I was there, I'd come up with another answer. But his friend just hooked his rig up, he says, and it works perfect. Everything's tuned one-to-one. Tuner, everything, handheld analyzer shows good. Everything, no problems, only when he puts his rig on. That's it. It don't work. And that went back to the manufacturer and all. I'm going to have to honestly say, I am going to have to say, I'm going to decline that I have a credible answer on this one. Take over.
John and Wesley, but you're missing a point here, Mel. When you send it back to the factory does a typical factory test. A perfectly shielded coax cable coming out of the rig into a perfect 50-ohm dummy load. Everything shielded. I am guessing the factory did not put it into an antenna of the type that your writer is using. The real antenna, although it's got the same 50 ohm impedance measured on an impedance analyzer, that real antenna is capable of launching a substantial amount of signal. Of the signal that went down the center of the coax cable and hit the antenna, a substantial amount of it is now capable of being coupled back to the outside of that cable. And it now travels down the outside shield of the cable into the shack, picked up by the microphone, the B-plus wiring, the 110-volt wiring, whatever. There's another mysterious path by which signal is getting back to the sensitive circuitry looking for reverse power and therefore false alarming it. So his conditions in his shack are not the same conditions that occurred at the factory. The factory doesn't test it the way he is really using it. So everybody could be telling the truth here, and so you could be getting these responses. It's not a capricious situation from my point of view. And by way of these lower power experiments, with and without the microphone, running on the Morse code key, and so on, switching the frequency, trying another band, there's a whole series of experiments to find out, will the transmitter transmit at all, even at low power output, into his antenna or into a dummy load in his shack? John, KT2WGB, what do you think is going on? K2RIW in the tech net?
JTB with him. Dick, great recommendations. I think you're right. I think if he lowers the power and try tuning with the tuner that he has, go to other bands and see what happens. But the first thing I would do if I was him, bring his rig to his friend's house and see if it works on his antenna. The difference, it may show something, you may be able to find something. That, I think, would be the easiest thing to talk to you, Dick.
Another excellent suggestion, John. I think we've got Wesley and Eric in that order, and then J2B also. Wesley, you want to make a comment on this? Into XJN, K2RIW.
Into XJN. Well, this situation recalls my memory from when I was young. We didn't have Yesu Kenwood or Igo. If you're transmitting at 3.5 megahertz, then the next harmonic will be 7, 14, 21, 28. Now, just assume that you don't have a proper filter. So most of the power is going to, let's say, 7 megahertz, because now you're transmitting at 7 megahertz. There's a little power that is going through the harmonic on 3.5. Now, you're getting a perfect match on 7 megahertz. 3.5 megahertz gets reflected. Now, the sensing device in the transceiver is say, no, I don't like it. I'm getting reflective power. Not from the main one. From the harmonic one. Back to you.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Wes. I've also run into that on 2 meters versus 432 and so on, where people get mysterious readings of standing wave ratio because of harmonic energy, even though the antenna on the intended frequency is a perfect 50 ohm load. And that you've run into that, I've run into that. I'm thinking that a modern gay guy will not run into that, because if the rig is meeting FCC requirements, all undesired frequency out of the rig are supposed to be, all undesired frequencies are supposed to be suppressed by 60 decibels or more. So although you and I have run into it, in theory it shouldn't be happening today anymore. Let's see, I think it was Eric, the next person who signed it. KE2EJ, you got a comment on this one? K2LIW in the tech man?
Get off the air, Sierra.
Yeah, the company mentioned to me that you guys were talking about broadcast circular polarization, but one thing I will say is that there are a lot of radios that, even though they're 60 dB down, if you actually look at them on a spectrum analyzer, they're transmitting all over the place. I know I've had one that's been that kind of a problem, so. Yeah, I mean, if you follow the, if the transmitter is following the rule, and the antenna looks like a perfect 50 ohm load, if the intended frequency, sometimes you wind up putting out energy, even though it may be 60 or 70 dB down, somewhere that it's not supposed to be. But going back to circular polarization, I don't know what makes it here, but somebody mentioned it. Somebody on the phone, so I turned the radio on. What was the question that Dave was being asked?
Yeah, if you can hang in there a little bit, I'm going to pick up the other two callers on this one and then come back to the CP question, Eric. The next person who signs in with a comment is going to be Lou and then ASS in that order. I think it was Joe. WJ2B, I think it was Joe. Go ahead, Joe, K2LIW.
Yeah, I just had a simple suggestion what the guy could try that's having problems with his radio. If he has excess coax there available on his antenna lead, is to try to coil it and into a tight coil and make a homemade ballon. And another thing he could try is to change the length of the coax, maybe add 2 or 3 feet onto the coax, and that might fool the radio into not seeing that SWR fallback situation, or possibly change the the whole characteristic of his antenna just by changing the coax. But I would also say a ferrite would be a very good suggestion. If the guy go to Radio Shack or somewhere and get his hands on some ferrites and clamp some ferrites onto the coax, onto the mic lead, and onto the power cable. And that would be my first recommendation. But I think, Mel, you could suggest those things to him just to try it. Whether or not that will actually fix the problem is yet to be seen. At least he has something he can try there and see if that works on WJTV.
I like the idea of moving the coax, changing the length, going to the friend's house with the rig and see if it'll work on the friend's antenna. Let's see. Did we pick up everybody who wanted to make a comment on this one?
Got one more comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, yeah, between you and Mel, you both said something, and I put it together, and it made a lot of sense. I could swear I heard Mel say something about, with the antenna tuner, he could barely tune the antenna or couldn't tune it. I thought I heard him make that comment, and that makes me start to believe that what you said might make some sense, too, that this guy is not transmitting on the frequency he's receiving on. He may not be on, you said, 40 meters. He may be on another band. so he may be doing the AB VFO or something like that. He's got to first put this thing into a dummy load, just start it with a dummy load, see if it will work at all, and then coax it back into the antenna and look at the SWR from this antenna. If it's unusually high with this radio, it's probably on the wrong frequency, like you said. Over.
The display will show.
Yeah, the display, usually on most transmitters, it'll tell you what frequency it's transmitting on, if you know to look at it and you know how to interpret it. So, maybe that's not a problem, but lots and lots of things to be tried here as I see it. Alpha Sierra Sierra, go ahead with your comment, sir. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Got it all wrong. That's not the way I read it.
I was just listening for a little bit, and I'm just taking a guess that if that radio is sending out harmonics of any kind, the SWR may show one-to-one on the particular frequency that both radios were set for, whatever it is, 20 meters, 40 meters, whatever it may be. But it's not going to be one-to-one where the erroneous frequencies are, or the harmonics, or whatever. So if it's not going to be one-to-one anymore, and he has a sensitive protection unit in that radio, is probably tripping it right out. But he could try other things. He could throw a meter in line and maybe ground the coax, at that point to see if that would bleed it off before it gets back to his radio somehow, on the output side of the meter, maybe. But there's a lot of experiments. Transmit with lower power could possibly, if it's a 50-watt radio, transmit it 2 watts and see if he gets out at all. And then slowly bring it up, and that would start making it trip. And they would never see that at the factory, because at the factory they're at ideal conditions. Everything is one-to-one, a dummy load, whatever they're using. That's all. And thanks for letting me have my piece. Take care, guys.
Now, Mel, when he was using the antenna tuner, many cases the antenna tuner, when you first line it up, the rig is running in a low power mode. And there it should be a lot less likely to trip out. So with the external antenna tuner manually being operated or automatically being operated, what is your feeling for what happened with the antenna tuner, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
With the antenna, let's put it this way. I'm going to boil this all down because that's why I cannot give this kind of answer. With the antenna and the antenna hooked up, using a handheld analyzer, everything shows proper. His friend even went through the trouble of bringing in another rig, his own rig, and it worked perfect. Now, the rig that he mentioned is not a cheap piece of junk. This is a pricey piece of equipment, Dick. So I'm going to rule out all that the display is wrong and this is wrong and everything like that. There's something more that's taking place here, and I don't understand. Maybe if I was there, if I was capable of getting there and all, I could come up with something. But I'm going to say right now, the only thing I can suggest, and I will give him the bottom line, I'm only going to suggest this to this one person, simple suggestion. Take your rig. Go to your friend's house. Let him get on the air with his rig. And then put your rig on with the same frequency and everything and see what happens. If it don't work, you call the manufacturer and you tell them what the situation is. Because there's something more ambiguous going on here. You can't tell me that the SWR is so far off that it's one-to-one on one rig and more so high on another rig that it will not work at all. It don't make no sense, Dick. Period. Over.
G2QIQ with a comment on this one?
Yeah, but Mel, when he used the antenna tuner, you didn't fill out the sentence on the last transmission. When he used the antenna tuner, what did he see? Over to you, Mel.
Basically, as I read it, with or without the antenna tuner, his friend's rig worked perfect. It worked perfect, he said. No problem. He put the tuner in, he took the tuner out, he got the bypass on the tuner, everything like that, the whole work. His friend showed him either way, one-to-one indication on the meter on the rig. Now, with his rig, nothing. Hooked it up, same thing. All it did, unscrew the coax cable, according to him, screw it onto the back of his rig, and it don't work. I'm puzzled there. Period. That's it. Go ahead.
Oh, there it is. His definition of not work is that every time he goes to the transmit mode, a red warning light comes on saying it will not transmit because of standing wave ratio. Is that the indication, Mel? Go ahead.
What he says exactly, it will not work at all. And like I say, I know this rig. This is a bit of a more than average price radio. This is not a piece of junk. So I'm going to tell you right now, forget about if the display is accurate and everything. And I'm sure that something more, and the manufacturer and all is also certifying. I'm sure that they went through a thorough test because they know what's going to happen after this. I have no answers to this one, Dick, period. Like I say, maybe if I was there, I'd come up with something. But as far as I know, this is the most ridiculous mystery I've hit in a long time over.
What kind of radio is it, Mel? Is it a mobile radio? Is it a possibility that it's a power supply that's giving him trouble?
And also, Mel, how local is the guy? Is he in our vicinity of the tri-state area where we can help him out? Back to you, Mel.
The problem, he's in a somewhat of a rural area, not many hands out there. Glenn, it's a radio with internal power supply. Go ahead.
Mel, did he say the radio will work into a dummy mode?
I don't know. I have no idea. This is as much information as I've got. I don't know if he has the availability of a dummy mode. The only thing I will suggest to him, the last bottom line of all this is, take it to your friend's house. If it don't work, if your friend's radio works on his antenna, yours don't work, I say you're going to have to take this up with the manufacturer and even go as far as to do something legal with them, because there's something going on here that's much more than run-of-the-mill. Over.
KB1IFY, what a comment. Three comments to go with Eric, KE2EJ. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, a few years back I ran into a situation that was similar. It turned out to be an open capacitor in the low pass filter with resistively, if you're a 50 ohm load, everything looks perfect. When you put it into an inductive mode, everything was completely wrong.
That error you described, was that in the transmitter, in the antenna tuner, in the antenna? Where was that error? Eric, go ahead.
No, as you know, all HF radios have to have low-pass filters to keep the junk from passing through. That's what you scan. There's usually a set of relays, another set of coils and capacitors that deal with that particular frequency. It might be a three- or four-pole filter. And the way they're designed in the radio, and I was only on this one band, so it drove me nuts for a while trying to find it, but eventually I came up with it. It was actually a capacitive reactive load that was not within the band path of the frequency that was supposed to, the band that it was supposed to be operating on. The cap was open. Resistively, it looked perfect. Put into a dummy load. Well, put it into any kind of an inductive load and if you SWR up the gain.
What you should know, Eric, is that I'm getting a potent signal from you on the input, 20 or 30 dB over S9, and you're a little bit noisy into the machine. So is your antenna possibly aimed away from the machine, Eric? Go ahead.
I just moved the car a couple inches. Is that any better?
Huge improvement. Okay, who are the other people who want to make a comment? Let's see, Wesley was one of them. I'll make a brief comment, Wesley. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chief. The most likely what Eric said is what is happening. The thing is that if he does have an access to another receiver instead of spectrum analyzer, where he can see immediately what's going on over there. He would be able to tune more, to other bands, ham radio bands, which most likely would be the harmonics, and see if he can hear the signal at low power. That's my suggestion in this area. But with all of the comments that I have heard, what may possibly happen, I believe that that what Eric has said is the most probable one.
I know that Eric is sitting in his car. He probably wants to go into the building, and so we called him in because of the circular polarization of the question. The question that was asked earlier, Eric, is of the broadcast stations, what percentage of the television broadcast stations and FM broadcast stations are now circular? To my knowledge, upper and lower VHF used to be purely linear back in the analog television days. With UHF television, I think a higher percentage have gone circular. And so to today, with digital television, what percentage of digital television broadcasting is circular? And to your knowledge, what percentage of FM broadcasting is circular? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, if we're talking about them, that's a little bit of a different story, because like on Empire, there's the Alpha antenna system, which is sort of like, oh, let's call it 45 degree polarization where the dipole is set up around the 102nd floor. If you were actually on the 102nd floor observatory and look down, you see these cement things that look like keys. They're actually dipoles. And they're kind of tilted at a 45 degree angle, and that's up and down. For the FM, that's really to try and compensate for the fact that, you know, you've got a lot of multipath, and you're intending to hit vehicles that are moving, the antenna bend, and so on and so forth. So with the amount of power that they're running, it's not circular polarization in terms of FM, but it is sort of cross polarization. That's one thing. And it drops. In terms of TV, even in the analog days, a lot of the low band and high band VHF used that wing, delta. They're both horizontally and vertically polarized, but they're not circularly polarized. The UHF is another story. The UHF, actually, a lot of them are spots, and the spots are designed to be circularly polarized. The reason for that is to try and combat multipath. In the digital world, just about everybody that is operating out of New York is circularly polarized. That's not the case throughout the rest of the country. Some of them are both horizontally and vertically polarized, but they're not circularly polarized, where they don't actually shift 90 degrees between the horizontal plane and the vertical plane. But the concept is, the reason for going circular polarization is it helps to minimize some of the multipath. It's your IWP.
When it comes to a polarization fade, in other words, a horizontal antenna with a vertical signal, that polarization fade, circular polarization, will help. When it comes to multipath interference to a digital converter and the intersymbol distortion that's created by the time delay of the multipath, you would get some improvement with circular polarization if the receiving antenna was copolarized circular. Let's assume that the transmitting clockwise and receiving clockwise, then at least one bounce off the ground, which makes it counterclockwise, would be somewhat rejected, and you get an improvement. I'm not convinced that over-the-air television reception antennas that a significant percentage of them are, let's say, circular, clockwise, polarized. Am I wrong on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, all home receiving antennas are generally horizontally oriented. But in the digital world, we also transmit now in this state and a few other places, there's mobile VTV. and circular polarization becomes more important for that type of operation. That's a whole nother long discussion about mobile digital television. We can get into that another day. But in terms of the fixed receiving, because most reflections will be of the opposite polarization, there is a benefit there. The jury's out in terms of, you know, how much benefit there is, but there's benefit. And when you are operating in a place like Manhattan, or in San Francisco, or in Los Angeles, it seems to be a worthwhile endeavor. When you're in Iowa, it doesn't mean much in terms of disruption, because you don't have all these big buildings to kind of put the radio in.
So let me go back to you one more time now. Could I almost say with slight assurance that essentially every single New York City digital television transmitter is circular polarized? Is that almost true, Eric? Go ahead.
That's almost true when we're talking about UHF, although you have channel 11, channel 7, channel 13, they're on that link, and they're not circularly polarized, but they are emitting their transmission both on the horizontal and the vertical plane.
Now, horizontal and vertical would suggest that they were co-phase, that I'm transmitting slant 45 degree polarization. If I don't have equal amplitude and exactly 90 degrees of phase shift of any other combination, I'm elliptically polarized. So do you believe the bat wing is favoring slant 45 degree polarization, or do you think it's making some kind of elliptical polarization? What's your guess on that one, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, Ogden Pentel is the inventor of that antenna. That's been from his days at RCA. And that, to this day, is still the argument, but I think it favors slant polarization. That seems to be the consensus of it. At this point in time, it seems to be old technology, but the reason is that those antennas are in existence, and that's what they're using. I haven't seen anybody come up with anything different at this point in time. And because VHF is part of the bygone era, I don't think anybody's putting anything in the into any kind of development there.
I do remember seeing a picture recently of the Dallas area Channel 2 transmitter that's on top of something like a 1,500-foot broadcast tower. And it's a whole array of circular polarized helical antennas, real CP, even on a VHF frequency, lower VHF. Did I hear for K4KNB, Bob signing in? Is that what I just heard? Go ahead.
Good evening, Dick. KQRAW from K4NBC. As far as I know, everything up on Empire is horizontal. And the FM antenna he's referring to is that Alfred antenna, which is only used now as a backup or when they're up on the tower working on antennas. KQRAW, K4NBC.
If the Alford antenna on the 102nd floor of Empire State Building is only used as a backup antenna, that seems to be the most ideal location in the world. I'm curious as to why that's not the primary antenna, Bob. Why use that as backup? What's more, what's so much better about the some other antenna? Sounds like Eric wants to make a comment on this first. KE2EJ, K2REW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, well, the Alfred antenna is actually lower than the community antenna. Actually, if you'll tune in tonight, you'll find that many of the transmitters are actually going through various different auxiliaries and some of them are being set down. They're still doing a lot of work up there. The FM, actually, many of the FMAs have left Empire, and the Alfred is the backup, and the main antenna antenna, which is another community antenna, which is way above where the alphas are, is what's being used by the FMAs in Empire. And those guys are pretty much horizontally and vertically polarized. As far as the TV stations, the VHF go, they're not just horizontal, they're horizontal and vertical. They are dielectric bat wings, which actually, when you add it up, they really become 45 degrees. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, I can tell that Bob feels that they're purely horizontal. And when I look at the bat wing antenna, so-called super bat wing, that's in the antenna engineering handbook, I believe it's described as a horizontally polarized antenna. Broadband and frequency, that's the good news, but linear and polarization in the usual embodiment of that kind of antenna. What have they done to inject a vertical component on the bat wing that you're speaking of, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW?
Well, the bat wings, as Senator said, they're actually sort of like a gamma match viewpoint because the whole thing is ground. But if you look at the construction of the bat wing, the main lobes are generated from the horizontal portion of the antenna. But if you look at the sides, they're kind of like a B, and that's where the vertical component comes in.
Okay. I think we should pick up Paul before he goes to sleep. WS2N, what's NASA doing that we should know about? And I imagine you're as disappointed as everyone else that that the space shuttle is about to all become museum pieces. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, it's still out there also, Dick.
Yeah, I know. Everybody's piled up. Paul first. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Okay. The signal dropping here a little bit. Conditions are changing. How copy, Dick?
You're very good in the machine. Don't worry.
Okay, very good. Yeah, just a couple of items I wanted to bring up. Yeah, of course, the manned space program is... we're not going to see anything launched by our government for many years to come. Probably at least 5 or maybe 10 years. I guess the next people you might see go up from the United States will probably be private corporations. But hopefully that will change. Hopefully they'll put money into the program to get it going, to accelerate things. Because they have a lot of things on the book. 15 years from now, you might see American astronauts walking on asteroids. That type of thing. So, we'll just wait. Right now, we'll concentrate on the robotic mission, such as, this was brought up a couple of weeks ago. Let me drop it. The JWST, that's the James Webb Space Telescope, one that's supposed to be put a million miles out in the Lagrange point, too. It really kind of won't orbit the Earth. Well, it really will once every year. But it'll follow Earth along its orbit around the sun. And they said it was canceled. I looked this thing up left and right. There's talk of it being cut, but I can't find anything that confirms that it's canceled. If you go to the James Webb site for the telescope, you know, there's nothing that leads you to believe that it is officially is canceled. I think that's still on the drawing board. It's many years away, but you know, right now, I don't think that's off the board. Right now, I don't think they cut that. The other thing I wanted to say is the Dawn spacecraft. We covered that many times on the net. That's the one that's on the way to two different asteroids, supposed to orbit one asteroid for a year and then go off to another one. Eventually orbit that one. It did go into orbit on the 15th of this month, so it's now in orbit around Vesta. That's that asteroid that was like 300 miles in diameter in eventually they're going to go on to the bigger one, Cirrus. So we'll see. But right now that's successfully in orbit. We drive it WS2S. And then the other the topic we cover is Curiosity. That's the Mars laboratory that's going to be launched at the end of this year, I believe in November now. It's been extended. It was August, but now it's November. Scheduled to land next August in 2012. They have decided on, out of hundreds of possible landing sites, something called a Gale Crater, named after an astronomer from Australia. But Gale Crater is the location, probably about 50 or 60 miles radius that it's got to hit. In the middle of it, they have this mountain, and it's a very high mountain. So it's going to have plenty of sites to look at. And this is the one that's going there. It doesn't have any solar cells or anything. It has a uranium on board, actually plutonium-based. So it's got a uranium generator to power the vehicle for probably, hopefully, quite a few years. So, you know, the site has been finally decided on. It's pretty close to the equator. It's a little south of the equator. I thought maybe they took a northern part, or, you know, maybe a southern part, but they headed right for the equator. Similar to what Spirit and Opportunity did. Both were pretty close to the equator. Of course, one was on one side of the planet and the other one was on the other side. We don't have that situation this time. We only have one that was built to land okay with the sky crane and all. We've talked about that before, how that thing's going to land. It's much bigger than Spirit and Opportunity. If anybody that hasn't listened to this part of the net, it's like almost 2,000 pounds. It's going to be about four or five times heavier than the existing rovers. For instance, the existing rovers are about 5 feet long. This is about 10 feet long. So it's a monster. Big 30-inch diameter wheels and all stuff. Let me drive it. This is WS2M. And another one that we could talk about in the future, not too far off, but 2013 landing. A new one that I've been reading about lately is something called MAVEN, M-A-V-E-N, and that's a spacecraft that's going to be launched in a couple of years. It's going to Mars. It's called the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution. It's really designed to find out what happens to the atmosphere of Mars. You know, it's the old story. Mars is much smaller than Earth, you know, and about half the pull of Earth, and gravity is much weaker, and they don't have a magnetosphere. You know, if you go there with a compass, you're going to have a hard time finding north, because they don't have a liquid sensor, a dynamo, like we have on Earth with its molten interior. So they don't have that, so you don't have the magnetic field protecting the atmosphere like we have here. So this thing's going to go there and evaluate that, all kinds of special instruments for a couple of years. It's going to be on a 70-degree inclination of Mars. And, it's just an orbiter. It doesn't have a landing vehicle. We need another one there, because we have had a couple of that eventually failed. Right now we have the Mars Express. Can we drop it? For our European Space Agency. Mars Global Surveyor. That one has stopped working. think I didn't have some problems with that. Mars Odyssey. I think that's not, you know, that's no longer. I think that still works as a repeater, but I don't know, that's got some problems. But we still do have the big one, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. I mean, that's a big thing. That's like the size of a minibus flying around. And that's very functional. But we could use a couple more around there. So my guess is they'll probably use this as a repeater as well for the rovers that are on Mars. Still got one functioning. The other one's not functioning. Careers out. Opportunities still in. And then eventually you're going to have this Curiosity. So that's up to date with some of the local robotic missions there. Couple more, you know, Messenger, that's still doing good around. Mercury, we can get into some of the other ones down the road, future nets. Back to you, Dick. WS2S. Interpol.
Go ahead, John.
Paul, have they made any special equipment or any adapters or something for them to be able to walk and be ambulatory on the asteroids, which probably are going to have like 1/100th of the gravitational pull? How are they going to be ambulatory and do their experiments?
Yeah, that's well, I mean, it does have gravity, but you don't want to jump off because if you take a rocket and throw it hard enough on an asteroid, you'll put it into orbit. So basically, how are they going to stay there? They'll probably similar to what Japan tried to do. It didn't work. When they had a lander land on one of the asteroids, it was supposed to fire these I'm going to call them spikes into the surface. It was going to hold itself there. I don't think that worked. Their goal was to land there and put some material into the spacecraft and then actually bring it back to Earth. But I don't think that worked out too good. So yeah, I'll have to come up with a different design. I mean, I guess you would get out of the spacecraft and just like walk real carefully. Because go to some of the big asteroids. I mean, if they go to Ceres, which is 600 miles in diameter, it's got some kind of a gravitational field. It's almost like a little planet. You know, you have to jump pretty hard to put yourself into orbit. I don't think they're too worried about that. They'll probably tether themselves to the spacecraft and all. Because you don't want to jump and, you know, find yourself floating 20, 30 feet in the air and coming down and breaking your space suit. Back to you, John.
Okay, Paul. Thanks for the info. I was just wondering, maybe tethering would be the way they do it, but that's going to be interesting. Over to you, Dick.
In the case of the James Webb telescope, which is going to go at a Lagrange point beyond Earth a million miles, further out away from the sun, I'm worried about how you orient it. In the case of the space shuttle, in the case of the Hubble Space Telescope, one of the high wear items with the gyros, almost every repair mission, you replace essentially all of the gyros. They seem to have a finite life. And that's what steers it in various directions when you want to move it from pointing at one star to pointing at another star. Has James Webb's design done something to drastically increase the life of those gyros and the power supplies and the other things that have been frequently replaced on the Hubble Space Telescope? WS2N, HULIW.
Yeah, no, Hubble had four gyros, and a couple of them failed over the five service missions. They changed them out. Batteries quite a few times. Now, whether they've upgraded that to the last, however many years they want this thing to last. I mean, but, you know what, Hubble went up, 1990 or something. So here we are 20 years down the road. To make this thing last 20 years, that's not going to happen. But I was thinking, one of the designs of the new crew vehicle. Now, I'm not going to call it Orion, but basically it's really Orion, the spacecraft. You can put four people in on board and